back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast. Recording a little bit earlier as we head into week two of the Premier Lacrosse League season that is 2023. I am Terry Foy, joined by Kevin Brown. This is going to be a little bit of a abridged, I guess, for lack of a better word, version of the PLL Happy Hour podcast. But we're going to deliver you the spicy margarita takes and the perfectly chilled, informed updates that you require in order to maximize your enjoyment of the PLL campaign that is now 1 week underway. Kevin, how are you?
Fired up. This is a great time of year for the fans of the PLL Happy Hour podcast because we're back and never been better.
No question. We are going to get back to our regularly scheduled recording on Thursday nights and bringing in a player or two and talking about what beverage we have in hand. But we weren't going to be able to do this, and we didn't want to let it go another week without discussing the Premier Lacrosse League season. So for this podcast, we're going to start by talking about week one, what we saw. We are going to then transition into some of the preseason content that we would have ideally gotten out last week. And then we're going to end by talking about week two in Charlotte, which gets underway on Friday evening. So, Kevin, we are going to start by talking about the four games that unfolded in opening weekend in Albany, New York, on the heels of training camp. And it got underway with a bang as the Ryder Garnsey Show led the Redwoods to a 13-12 victory over Atlas. He scored 6 goals after, in my memory, putting up 17 goals in all of 2022. This certainly a reflection of some of the offseason moves that were made, including trading Matt Cavanaugh to the Cannons in order to make a little bit more room for Garnsey on the left side. And the story of this game, as he was interviewed by Kesnick multiple times throughout, was the best week ever. Garnsey is the volunteer assistant for Notre Dame, and on Monday he won the program's first national championship after having been an alum, a part of several teams that fell short of that program high watermark, and after winning a championship, immediately heading north to Albany and taking care of business was one of the best showings of his pro career. It was not just that he put up 6 goals. It was also the fashion in which he scored them. Highlight reel after highlight reel goal that Garnsey has come to be known for. Obviously, that's an oversimplification, and there's a fair amount of this game that has to be discussed as well. But what was your takeaway from the first game of the weekend?
Well, Terry, you hit on the most important parts, but we'd be remiss not to mention the record-breaking nature of the first bang of the season, it being on ABC. It's the first of 8, I want to say, ABC games this whole season, and it's started off with the most viewed outdoor professional game on record. So we had a peak of 782,000 viewers and 543,000 viewers average throughout, right? And there couldn't have been a better game. I'm sure we gained some lacrosse fans from this on the back of the heels of the epic Final Four going into this. Just a dream start, I feel like, for the fifth year of PLL action. Yeah, the Ryder Garnsey goals, one-upping himself, stop-dropping, rolling, firing, scoring a backhander with the defense all over him. It was insane to watch. Chris Gray had a nice one-hander. Xander Dixon was excellent in his pro debut, as I continue to underestimate his abilities and his no-look fling towards the back of the net that went with about 35 seconds left was insane. This game had everything. The late game drama of the full field fling from Romar Dennis, where I thought it was a cool moment of Mike Pressler just completely overriding his assistant coaches and his pro debut and being like, no, this is how we're going to do it. Romar is going to shoot it towards the net, and we're going to try to get the rebound. That's exactly what happened. Eric Law caught it and dove turned, dove, his twister effort went wide. It was a very epic game. I thought it was cool to hear Redwoods coach Nat St. Laurent post-game was pretty ticked off that the Law got that shot off, and understandably so when he had a nice callback to the 2016 Major League Lacrosse final where Law's Outlaws, he caught a pass from Sieverts with like 16 seconds left and scored and to beat St. Laurent. And John Grant Jr. was actually the year that he played for the Machine, lost that final, went back to the Outlaws. The Machine beat John Grant Jr. and the Outlaws. But all in all, it was just an epic opener. The matchups, when the schedule came out, I was just mouthwatering at the matchups this weekend. And we weren't really treated to some of the draft picks, and obviously all the Chaos contingent weren't playing with the Bandits and the finished up business with their epic final up in Bandit Land. But all in all, I think the season openers were pretty epic.
One of the elements of this Redwoods victory was that they were able to overcome the fact that Trevor Baptiste went 19 for 28 facing off against his Team USA teammate in T. Erlin, who won 10 of 26. What did you take of the faceoff matchup?
Yeah, and the other cool thing that so obviously just to catch fans who aren't quite up to speed yet, the new faceoff rules are after you win a face-off, the shot clock goes down to 32 seconds as opposed to 52 seconds. And it's been a learning process, learning curve for everyone. And obviously, it was a point of emphasis for all eight clubs in training camp. With if you win it backwards, you definitely can't sub all three players off to get your offensive personnel on. If you win it towards the sideline, you're more likely to. We saw a lot more face-off guys stay on, and which made Trevor's domination all the more impressive. He stayed on a lot and still dominated probably the second best guy in the league, the guy who will be backing him up in San Diego for Team USA. It was a showing from the reigning MVP that is, again, indicative of kind of his superiority, I think, against everyone else in the league. So you're kind of just hoping as a head coach, GM, just for someone to come in and try to make it a scrap against him. And Trevor's doing something really cool this year. He's donating $100 for every face-off win. He won 19 of 28. The opening week, he's donating it to every face-off when he's donating $100 to support inner cities. So that's another great little tidbit there for the whole season. So it's going to be a good chunk of change for Baptiste, knowing how good he is. So it's been cool to see how teams are starting to adapt to this new role, and I'm interested to see hear your take on if you have one formulated yet with how well the game flows in terms of the new shot clock. But I thought it was cool. The offense gets sped up. I don't think the value of faceoff wins really goes down. But in terms of game flow, just still figuring it out for every club.
Yeah, let's save that for after we get through the first four games. Let's save it. And we can come back to it. In terms of analyzing this game a little bit more, one thing that stood out to me was the role that Westberg kind of filled in his return to the Redwoods. And Rob Pinnell went 0 for 7 shooting and finished with 4 assists. And his team put up 13 goals despite having a significant face-off disadvantage. And it speaks to me that they were incredibly efficient offensively in spite of, you know, that shooting performance. And I feel like it is a really nice situation for Rob to be in, flanked by Garnsey on the left side, and I don't think that he's going to score six goals again this season, certainly much less consistently. But I also think that Berg might score five. So, you know, point being that the combination of shooter-slasher that each guy represents, I think does complement Pennell as the facilitator really well. You know, and what's interesting is, did you feel like you felt the force of Miles Jones and Sergio Perkovic in this one? Jones finished 1-for-2 shooting, and Perkovic finished 0-for-2 shooting. So from the midfield standpoint, it was really much more Nekhai Montgomery, who had an awesome game with 3 goals and 6 ground balls, than it was kind of those stars.
Yeah, I think so. Nekhai, first off, what an awesome performance. It was a total Zach Currier-esque game from him in terms of his impact on the wings. He played more defense than offense, and he won most of those matchups, held Romar Dennis scoreless, went matched feet set for set on that end. And you saw it on the offensive end. He was able to distribute in terms of when he led the fast breaks, coming out and jumping out from the Jack Kelly saves, or even inverting from X off short shot clock situations, a quick end line sprint, and then he beats his man and beautifully timed cross crease feed over to Ryder, I think, for his second or third goal of the game. And you brought up Westberg there. He was sort of a overlooked player in terms of when I was kind of doing these power rankings to start preseason. I pointed out as Ryan Lee is the key player for this Redwoods offense when he comes back from Colorado Mammoth duties. And I think we saw why, because from this opening game with how well Berg fit in there, I think Lee will come in and give that next level of productivity over Berg. Not to say Berg is washed by any means. We saw his hat trick and 2 very important goals in the fourth quarter prove otherwise in week one action. But I think Lee just has another step in. Obviously, he's wearing the big bulky right knee brace and everything that comes with that. But Berg fit in seamlessly. He's got that built-in chemistry with John Garn Jr. and their time with the Outlaws together. So he's got the finishing, the high lacrosse IQ, and everything that goes with that. So the midfield-wise, Jules Henningberg, I wanted to see a little more initiation from. But I thought kind of the flip side of that was how Atlas was playing them. They deployed Gavin Adler on Rob Pennell in a sort of big red royalty matchup for the opening week as the number one pick for the Bulls, suited up down low, which kind of surprised me, not in terms of that matchup, because I think obviously he held him over 4 scoring. He was still able to distribute, of course, but seeing Brett Makar play LSM was not, I don't want to say dumbfounding, but close to that, because that's not really known for his skill set in terms of covering up top, creating havoc on the wings of faceoff, scooping up ground balls. He's doing all of it. He looked really good in that role and kind of quelled some fears that, what is Pressler doing with this lineup? He released Cade Van Rapphorst early this week ahead of week 2 action. And Kobe Smith is now on the reserve roster, so he could be inching his way up, but he seems to like that versatility between Makar and Krejcik at LSM. So those defensive personnel questions are really interesting to follow with Atlas and how different teams attack that going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it'll also be interesting relative to Jack and Cannon is such a unique goalie in how effective he is at stopping close shots. And so the fact that he finished with 8 saves and let 13 goals in, suggests to me that there's a learning curve relative to the shots that they want to give up, because he is better than a 38% goalie on a year-long basis. And, you know, this was a game where offense definitely won the day. Jack Kelly finished at 47%. But in a one-goal game, each one of those saves or each one of those non-saves is a huge factor in the outcome. At the other end of the field, what was your – so you know, my impressions were Eric Law, we mentioned he got an opportunity to potentially tie the game late. He had a couple of good opportunities that he missed throughout the game. He, at the same time, shot 4 for 8 and added an assist. So another very impactful game for him. Jeff Teat had the inverted stat line with a goal and 4 assists. And Xander Dickson made his debut. It was crazy, the fact that, you know, that Garnsey goal was my favorite goal that we referred to in terms of the stop, drop, and roll. And yet there were two goals from this game that ended up on the SportsCenter top 10, and that wasn't one of them, because Dickson had a flinging backhand falling down goal that was incredible. But for me, two stories that emerge for the Atlas. The first being Danny Logan didn't finish the game with an abdominal injury. That's something to watch, particularly with respect to U.S. national team consideration, as he'll report for the World Championship at the end of the month. But also, Chris Gray, 1 for 8 shooting. What did you take away from Gray's performance?
So there's a number of things that fall with that. I think the shots that he did get off were, and we'll see if I get this wrong when I go back and watch the film again, but we're closer to the end of shot clocks and just had to get the shot off, and defense were covering him pretty well. But I didn't really take too much negatively away from his performance. I think Jeff Teat and Xander Dickson are starting to formulate a good chemistry. Although Dickson just seems like Eric Law copycat coming out of the box instead of from behind the goal. So it'll be interesting to see how well they all mesh together. My biggest takeaway, actually, Terry, was the last year, this Atlas group seemed so deep in the midfield. You had Romar Dennis, Jake Caraway, never seeing the time of day on the playing field, with Brian Costabile and Dax Aitken and Daniel Bucaro all getting these minutes. Bucaro is still in the player pool, like, or in limbo in terms of his unsigned contract from the offseason as he weighs retirement, reportedly. There's the Romar Dennis carryover from the championship series. I don't think was going to be as hyped up as much as other fans believed it to be. The Sixes format with a 2-point arc is just so much different than how Romar is going to be deployed in the current PLL rule sets. And Brian Costabile continued to do Costabile things. He only made 2 of his 8 shots. Had another nice lefty on the run take down the left alley, which was pretty nice. But just the disparity from last year to this, to seeing the midfield initiation kind of get depleted this year. You see Marco Rourke get playing time, and they're bringing in Steven Rafis, who got cut by the Cannons. And now it's the defensive side that who's going to get my minutes, how is the chemistry going to form that way. It's really interesting to follow, because the defense was really week by week stay the same, whereas the offense saw so much turmoil from the game day rosters last year, and now it's the inverse this year. So how that plays a role into things, and how Chris Gray can kind of wiggle his way into that righty wing initiator role, I think it's still just going to take some time to get used to the new personnel.
Anything more on Redwoods Atlas, or are you ready to move on to game number 2?
Yeah, let's move on. Although you did point out that Danny Logan, that we talked off air about the implications with him and playing for Team USA and he's suited up on the active roster again this week, which I think is just amazing. He is, I guess, good to go, which is he went down late in the second half during week one action, came off the PUP list very late to get activated. So they have Chet Camizio as a rookie, was first team All-American, and it's one of those positions, obviously it's a learning curve, but you saw Danny Logan come in as a rookie from Denver, and he's won the last two short stick defensive midfielders of the year award. So it's going to be interesting to see how healthy he is come game time.
So after the incredibly dramatic finish and highlight reel ridden opening game of the season, we were treated to a 1-0 first quarter as the Cannons got the lone goal on the tally, but then it turned into the highest scoring goal of the or highest scoring game of the weekend from there, featuring an 11 goal third quarter and a 10 goal combined fourth quarter as the Archers took a 16-13 victory over the Cannons. And I think that the best place to start is rookie Mike Sisselberger, who finished 24 of 30, picked up 14 ground balls. And that's a big ground ball to face-off win ratio for the PLL. And, you know, just a really controlling performance that took a ton of pressure off of basically every other aspect of the field. But to the extent that the Cannons were able to get looks, they put 13 goals in, and Brett Dobson had to make 16 saves. So I actually think that, you know, for me, I think both teams have a lot to feel good about coming away from this one. I mean, the Cannons obviously were the worst team in the league last year. They missed the playoffs. They lost their best player, right, in Lyle Thompson, who's foregoing this season. And yet, despite really being at a faceoff deficit, they were really competitive throughout the game against an Archers team that is also reinventing itself after losing Marcus Holman and Will Manny. But the offense wasn't the problem for the Archers. And so as a result, I think that if you're a Cannons fan, you can feel pretty good about the direction that this team is heading. Was that your takeaway as well?
Yeah, 100%. And I'll start with the Cannons just because I don't have as much to say about them in terms of positive reinforcement for their fans. Coming into this season, you could not have had very high expectations for this Cannons group. New coach Brian Holman comes in. He brings in his son Marcus. He finishes with a team high 5 points along with Asher Nolting. Asher, I think this year is going to be super important for him in terms of taking those strides as the quarterback attackman that we've come to know and love from his high point days. So just seeing the overall fight and resilience from this Cannons group to never be out of the contest on Saturday was really impressive. They never seemed to get within or without three goals within the Archers. So the Archers couldn't really ever put them away is what I'm trying to say. But the Cannons, Matt Campbell is going to obviously improve. He looked a little tentative at times to kind of take over the midfield initiation because he was pulled mostly. And I think once he does get unlocked, those throwback passes to Ryan Drenner, that was really nice, a really great look that turned into a goal. Ryan Drenner continues to be productive with a hat trick. Donville is going to be key for their off-ball stuff. And honestly, the defense looked pretty good. It's a totally different group down there this year. Kyle Hartzell was leading the way with some high effort plays to start the game out, and then Finn Sullivan looked probably their best pole option down there at close, and Adam Gittleman, whether he mentors Curse from the sideline or splits halves with him is I think a storyline to watch for Holman's group, but I think a big stride starting on week one, but the headlines coming out of this one is definitely all Archers. Mike
Yeah, I think
Sissel Berger.
your point was right in the sense that they were never really able to separate and kill the game. And I thought that the, you know, it was a 2-0 game going into the fourth quarter, and the game defining sequence was Trailer Player scored with 10.5 minutes to go to put the Archers up, put the Archers back up three, and Mike Sisselberger scored off of the faceoff 6 seconds later to put them up four, and the Cannons were able to close it back up to two, but never get within two as Connor Fields responded and extended it back out to three, and that was ultimately where the game ended up finishing. And for me, you know, it speaks the fact that Trey LeClair had, you know, a very important, like, kind of momentum rebuffing goal, and then it was compounded by a face-off goal speaks to two of the things that are really important in terms of understanding this Archers team. Their identity was so closely tied to Marcus Holman, Will Manny, Scott Ratliff, and Adam Gittleman. All four of those guys are gone. And so what you have left is Grant Ament and Tom Schreiber. And it's not to undersell the other guys in terms of their involvement, but this is year five of the PLL. And when you think of the Archers, like, those are the only six guys, or those are the first six guys that come to mind, and only two of them are still on the team. So I think a combination of the contributions down the roster from LeClaire or, you know, Connor DeSimone or whomever, like, those are really important, especially as Connor Fields kind of reemerges as a dodger, as a dodging threat that complement, like, all those sidearm underhand skip passes that Grant is going to throw, and then Mecca Keefe on the backside being the hammer to convert those. But again, in the same way that we talked about Danny Logan's injury, Grant Ament didn't finish this game either.
And unlike Logan, Amen is off the game day roster, not even on the reserve roster for week two action. So looks like Chris Bates, he said we're just being a little more conservative week one. Looks like they're going to stay conservative for week two and keep him out of the lineup completely. Look for a Deeso, O'Keefe, Fieldsy attack line for Charlotte, and I think it'll be fine. You saw how good. This is probably the most NLL I've watched all my life. So seeing how well Fields played for Rochester after getting traded away again, and he's been traded so many times at the pro level in both leagues, it feels like that he's just like, look, I'm still this really good player. And obviously the homecoming in Albany helps with the between the legs highlight of the weekend, but I think his presence is going to be huge in week two again without Amen in action. But you're spot on with how important LeClaire was. He had a couple of really nice righty sweeps, and his shot is looking dialed in. So he's provided enough for plays all over, and we'd be remiss not to mention Latrell Harris, who that's why I really wanted to mention the NLL season because I really enjoy watching him with the Rock. His speed doesn't fly off the screen the same way it does when he's unleashed in PLL action, flying off those face-off wings or from Dito. He had a couple ground balls or five ground balls and a couple of calls turnovers, and he was just stellar. Connor Maher and Piper Bond both played really good minutes, and so much so that they released an OG Archer and Mark McNeil this week. So they're both looking like the players we thought they were in college, and Maher especially, I think maybe even better than his last season in North Carolina. He's still a teamer for most All-American list, I think every list, and just seeing him get that slow break goal and bury it bottom right was pretty cool for him. But the headliner is still Sisselberger in terms of his chip on the shoulder of still being peeved about Team USA tryouts and not making the national team. That really excites me. I think that kind of energy is super, super cool to see, and just him being transparent about it. Like, yeah, I know I can go against these guys. And poor Stephen Kelly had to feel the brunt of it. and Sisselberger won 80% of his draws and was just fantastic. They're the number one offense in the league last year with Manny and Holman, so they weren't the problem. But in terms of when the game did slow down in postseason play, or when they didn't get the ball as much, and they're getting short sticked, as those game plans came in pretty consistently throughout last season, I think this new look offense, you can't really do that. And without Ament this week, look for a guy like Matt Moore to like even step up more than he did in the Oprah.
I've got a fireball take for you. You ready?
Let's hear it.
I want to see Tom Schreiber play at X for a quarter. I just want to see what it looks like. I have zero expectation that it would happen. I just want to see what it looks like.
But you know he could, because so go back and watch the final goal that iced it, and him, he may have even circled the whole field twice. And then when he got back to X and got topside to his right hand, didn't look like he was about to shoot at all, and he just unleashed this underhand riser to beat Kirst. Oh my god, the heat on that thing. And you know you can play at X with the indoor game with all those dunks and diving goals, so that would be especially fun to see with his athleticism. But let's keep him healthy for the World Games, and then we'll talk.
So keeping it moving, moving on to Sunday. I mean, if the Cannons and Archers fans can both feel better after that game, I feel like both the Water Dogs and Chaos fans need to feel worse after the Water Dogs emerge 8-7 victors over a very shorthanded Chaos team in overtime. Nick Rowlett won 13-18 faceoffs against Zach Tucci, and I think you can feel good about that draft pick one game in. But at the same time, it was Connor Kelly's game winner that ultimately iced it for the Water Dogs. What's interesting about this is, you know, the Water Dogs were playing without Dylan Ward, and I don't think that you can be upset with the performance that Matt DeLuca put in. You know, I think for me, this was just, and I suppose I'll defer to you, was it bad offense or good defense that won the day in this one?
It was so tremendous defense from both teams.
What a cop out.
Well, so your initial statement was 100% cat, because the Chaos should feel really good after holding Water Dogs to 8 goals, forcing them to overtime. And I mean, you can't expect much with those replacement players, which is, hey, you're all great players, but you need the lead of the elite at this level. And missing those Bandits players was obviously going to hurt them. But I was really impressed with the defense. Like, it all starts with Blaze. He had 18 saves back at Albany. Will Bowen looked really good. Jack Rowlett held Sowers to just a goal. And it's definitely good news for Chaos fans that they forced the Water Dogs to overtime, and they just didn't get trounced like some of the openers last year that we saw. And listen, you mentioned Nick Rowlett. What a great find that was in terms of Max Adler's. He could be back this week, but they're keeping him on the reserve roster, seeing if they can get another awesome week out of Rowlett. Let Adler rest a little bit. I heard he was on the sidelines already day after the Bandits win, if that timeline even makes sense. I think it was just good news for the Chaos contingent.
Right. Well, I'm really excited. I don't think I've ever been accused of cap. So I just it's a new day for your boy. Very much enjoying that, and it's going to be the highlight of this podcast for me for sure. Let's bring down the week one review by talking about Chrome's 12-11 win over the Whipsnakes, with Snakes playing without Zed Williams as he was finishing up his season with Colorado Mammoth. But that being said, you know, once again, an interesting kind of starting point from the Faceoff X with a rookie, Petey Lasala, winning 13-24 and picking up 6 ground balls, going primarily against Connor Farrell. And, you know, you made the comment coming away from the weekend that you would have thought that would be one of the worst matchups for him over the course of the entire PLL season on the basis of the physical mismatch. You know, Farrell speaking really highly during the game of what Lasala brings to the table. Similar goalie play at each end of the field with Sean Skinnone finishing at 56% and Kyle Brunlor finishing at 55.6%. Jackson Morrill is taken over as the quarterback in Brendan Nickdern's absence. Nickdern is going to struggle to make the Sunday games, if I understand it correctly, this season based on his U.S. Military Academy commitments. And Morrill put in a goal and 4 assists, which is really special based on, you know, his versatility and what he's shown over the course of his PLL career. And for the Whip Snakes, a vintage performance from Mike Chanin-Shuck. But ultimately, it was Carras Ferreira, the rookie out of Salisbury, who, in a incredible announcer's jinx moment, picked up a ball off of a sideline restart with about 12 seconds left, swept right-handed over the top of the Whipsnakes defense, got a step on Tyler Warner, who is the reigning sure-stick defensive midfielder of the year. And, no, 2 years ago?
Yeah, a couple years ago. Danny Logan's got the last couple.
That's right. And beat Brunlor to the Brunlor's already, so it was stick side pipe, right?
Lefty, so offside.
Lefty, so it was offside pipe, offside hip.
Yeah.
But just stuck it right inside the pipe. It was a great shot on the run. Yeah, Carras Ferreira, your boy. What was your reaction to that game winner?
The fields of Middletown, Delaware, Terry, to the fields of the All-American days at Appaquinimic High School, to the fields of the legendary Salisbury, where he finally gets the elusive title. Oh my gosh, what a week it was for Cross. And yeah, you called it the announcer jinx. Oh, him for times a million. And Ryder can probably express himself a little more eloquently in terms of how nice the week was for him and the luck of the Irish and best week of my life and all that. Whereas Cross is just, yeah, man, happy to be here. They want to keep playing me. I want to keep playing. So you just love that. It's kind of the reverse energy of the Sisselberger on-field interviews where he gives you everything that you're looking for from a media perspective. And you look across, he's like, listen, man, I just love lacrosse, D3 life, and I'm coming in there. I don't know what to do, what else to do with 10 seconds, but my favorite move, sprint right and then get topside and fire it above the offside shoulder. Like, come on. What a moment. I've watched that goal probably 90,000 times. It's unbelievable. I can't believe he did that. I was dumbfounded that he was in the lineup. I was surprised that he was starting. And never again will Kark or I bet against Cross. If you have a wedding to go to, I don't think it should be counted against you, but Pseudo loves these lax rats where the day after he didn't party for his D3 national championship. He came right on the bus, the plane, whatever it took to get to Albany. And he's at camp the very next morning after the Salisbury championship, which he spent his whole career trying to get. And to go from that to that shows the commitment level, the passion he has for the sport. And he's still super athletic coming out of college. And, you know, Lloyd's not even on the reserve roster this week. So he may have lost his spot to Cross Ferreira, the legend.
You mentioned super athletic, and there were three super athletic middies that made their debut in this game. Sam Hanley had a goal and an assist and for the Chrome and for the Whip Snakes. Tucker Dordovic had 2 goals and an assist. Garrett Lemon had a goal and an assist. Dordovic, 2-for-13. A stat line that we've seen a few times. What was your takeaway from those three guys?
Joe Keegs tweeted out the best spin zone for the Dorovic shot count, and it's that creating shots is in fact very hard to do. Creating separate the space to, needed to get those shots off at this level shows just how athletic he is. It's just you've got to dial it back maybe a tad to get it more within the offense. The biggest key that Coach Jim Sagnito is looking forward to address this offseason was midfield initiation, and he solved that through drafting Tucker Dorovic with the 6th overall pick in the draft. But the second one was shooting accuracy. They were worse in the league, and those kind of go hand in hand with picking up Dorovic and picking up Manny in free agency. And Manny was what, 2 for 5? The accuracy is starting to get solved, but you just need to get in Tucker's head to maybe pass some of those off and live with taking around 6 or 7 shots per game.
Matt Rambo, 0 for 1 shooting, 3 assists. Not a typical Matt Rambo game, but a typical Matt Rambo game in the sense that he's always been a player who's figured out what his team needed from him in order to help them try to win. Obviously, in this game, they fell short, but his willingness to adjust his role or contribution is different. What did you make of his performance?
Yeah, it's not really ring the alarm time for Whipsnakes fans in terms of last year. Their ability to pull off these close wins all season long was really impressive, but definitely not sustainable. And coming into this season, and it's kind of the same sort of defensive looks on Matt Rambo in terms of just shutting him out and try to avoid him getting the ball completely. And I think that's what JT Giles Harris and company tried to do with him throughout. And he was like, listen, if you're going to try to do that, we're going to have more space offensively and burn you. Unfortunately, Dorovic and other guys didn't do it enough. Mike Chanichuk started off very well and had 5 points overall, which was great for his season opener. But Matt Rambo has this kind of personality where he can be indifferent in terms of how many stats he'll put up in any sort of game. So, and listen, they know the game plan better than I do, but there's not too many other initiators when you're missing Zed Williams in the lineup to kind of take that weight off. So getting him back is going to be huge for the Whips moving forward.
Agreed. Yeah, that's kind of that's where I settle, which is that, like, you know, he hasn't been the most consistent player over the course of his career, but his high is as high or higher. I mean, his high is MVP level high. And so it's just imprudent to overreact to what they look like until he's in the lineup. So, you know, that being said, there was a lot about the Chrome that were so improved year over year, 22 to 21, that I saw from this team in week one. So I think if you're a Chrome fan wondering how much of it was attributable to Nichtern and how much are you going to struggle in his absence, and then also, you know, how much of it might have been a one-year blip, I think that there were some very positive returns in week one, specifically, you know, from a ball movement standpoint and some of the other stuff that we've already talked about. Kevin, any more?
And just Sam Hanley coming in. Yeah, just, I mean, Sam Hanley coming in, dropping to 4th overall, 3 defensemen to start the draft off. He gets that last slot for the higher paid rookies in terms of the tiers for everyone makes the $25K for 3 years, and he's in that kind of the elite rookie bracket pool, if you will. And he had that nice brush Ty Warner side. Tough game for Warner with the game winner and this highlight reel play with Hanley's goal, but he got back to his right to the middle of the field, overpowered Bernlohr and net. Look to see more of that. The offense is, as a whole, if you get Nichtern, if Malloy comes back in the lineup, if mixing those in with Logan Wisnowskis, who we didn't even mention, makes everyone better. Hanley's role in that offense in terms of, and I wrote about this after the draft, he doesn't have to do it all like he did in Penn. He can take a step back and make the right play like he did for most of this season with the Quakers, and kind of was criticized for it a little bit in terms of not taking games over because he was so physically dominant. And now that he has the chance to make sure he's making the right play every time and kind of can stay within the confines of the offense, he's going to be a special player at this level for sure. As for weekend as a whole, 3 1-goal games, an overtime game, dramatic finishes all around. Can't ask for much more. And Terry got me super pumped for week two.
All right. Well, like I said, you know, there were some broad topics that we wanted to talk about in terms of, you know, the entire season. So first on the list that we had is rule changes. And you mentioned, you know, the primary one, which is shortening the possession clock after the faceoff win to 32 seconds, the standard clock being 52 seconds. You said that you didn't – I guess what I would say is this. You know, I had someone whose favorite player is a midfielder mentioned to me last year that they felt like the clock was really starting to affect how much they felt like their favorite player was involved in the game. And so I started noticing it toward the end of the year, and then I feel like this only exacerbates it. So my starting point, and I feel similarly about another one of the big rule changes, which is they brought the side of the two-point arc closer in. So essentially created the corner three that you hear about in basketball. They created that shot for lacrosse.
Corner three.
I guess I know the answer to the second question or the second rule change, which is Joe Keegan is the one who has been asking for that for years. But who is asking for the 32-second shot clock after a faceoff win? Like, where did that
certainly come from? Not the faceoff specialist. That's for sure. Sisselberger was funny. He was like, man, I got to get sprinting, get these more sprints in, get these good conditioning. So. Yeah,
you said earlier that you don't think that it decreases the value of a faceoff win, and I think that's cap.
Yeah, no, it might be like three quarters cap,
40%.
So, yes, I was capping, and it definitely does decrease the value of faceoff wins. But I was also talking it out of both sides of my mouth because I thought the way that Sisselberger scooped it so quickly and got it to his offense relatively quickly in they mostly had 20 seconds minimum to work with the shot clock. Whereas Baptiste, because Erlin is probably a tier above Stephen Kelly, made those scraps and made him go behind. And even when you have to win the faceoff out the back and clear it, it's still 32 seconds. So a lot of times they're only dealing with 15 seconds left in the shot clock, which is a huge disadvantage for the offense. Right. So I don't know who was calling for it, but it's definitely caused a lot of uproar with the faceoff community. I know that.
We did not see a two-pointer scored from that, like below the break is what it's referred to in basketball, correct?
Correct.
Did we see one attempted?
I didn't. And yeah, the only player I can think of that will... There's two players, and it's Marcus Holman and Will Manny, I think, are the sharpshooters from low angles. And what you have to do is, like, a little mumbo the wing screen at the crease and get the guy out from the opposite wing where he's accustomed and sling it that way, even further decreases his angle because he doesn't have a stick to the inside. So it's, I can't imagine trying to formulate plays using it, but
I'm sure Keegs has got some. I think the only realistic scenario in which it gets utilized is in transition. I think that Mike Sawyer and Eric Lusby are the like prototypical guys that would have taken advantage of it because they were so Like, I mean, it was the geometry of that offense. I've talked about it on a bunch of podcasts. I've written about it a bunch of times previously. But, like, the geometry of how far they were able to stretch defenses width-wise, whereas typically you think about it in the context of stretching defenses vertically from the standpoint of range shooting when we talk about Sergio Perkovic or something like that. Like, they were so accurate from low angles that you know, 14, 15 yards out, that it was really dangerous, and they would have taken advantage of this. I do think that it's going to be stay low on the break in order to make that slide longer, but also make it pay off because you have a higher percentage shot at a two. You know, that tactically is how I envision this being utilized most significantly.
The other one is the goal I described, Schreiber scoring at the end of the Archers game, where if you are in a more desperate situation than the one he was trying to close the game out in, and you need a couple goals quickly, if you have an athlete, playmaker like that, and you're running up the hash and turning fire before you hit the 15-yard mark instead of shooting from 13 with, albeit, less angle, I think that's probably the other way in terms of attacking from inverts.
So this is a nice segue into one of the other topics that I wanted to touch on from a season-long basis, and that was this being the first season that comes on the heels of the championship series and what we saw from Sixes. And obviously, you know, I think that the biggest takeaway was the role of the two-pointer was much more substantial than originally anticipated heading into the event, and why, you know, Atlas were so successful and Romar Dennis was so successful. And it felt like a little bit of a, you know, welcome home, so to speak, moment, in the sense that, you know, he wasn't as dominant in the Atlas's loss as he was in the championship series. What was your reaction to the influence that the Champ Series had or didn't have on this weekend's action?
Yeah, just the differences, right, with the way defenses would play Romar coming out of defensive possessions where he can essentially clear it with no one pressuring him for up until the semifinal and final, where the Chrome and, I think, Whipsnakes both employed full court presses, and that really slowed down the Bulls' opportunities to cash in on those highlight reel two-pointers that Romar would just pull up from right beyond the midfield line and just bomb a jump shot right at the top corner. His shots are beautiful, but the way he... Like, guys know he's, like, I don't want to call him a one-trick pony, but defenses can definitely press out on him coming out of the box, make that a priority, and as long as they don't lose track of him, it's going to be hard for him to get the same shot quality, same opportunities for as quality as those shot looks were, as he did in the championship series. And he's really the one we are singling out because he scored the most points, scored the most goals in that championship series. And it's the biggest kind of symbolic shift from that event to the more traditional PLL rule sets. So the changes otherwise, I think it's clear that the Sixes and the pace and everything else is obviously going to be different. So, yeah.
So in that respect, you didn't see a ton of carryover.
Correct.
It was good to have long poles back.
Yeah. Now the long poles are back. We got to see some pulling up from long range week two here, though.
So perfect segue into talking about week two. We've got a Friday-Saturday weekend, and then we have one more Friday-Saturday weekend as they head to Ohio State's lacrosse stadium for the first time in week three. And then we've got an international break as teams break to go to San Diego and participate in the World Lacrosse Men's Championship. So real quick, 60 seconds. We got Chrome Archers, a battle of one-on-one teams, and then Water Dogs Redwoods, 6 and 8:30 on Friday night. All four undefeated teams play on Friday. All four 0-1 teams play on Saturday with Whips Atlas, the Hopkins Maryland matchup, unfortunately scheduled for Charlotte, North Carolina, at 3 o'clock on ABC, and then Chaos Cannons following at 5:30 on ESPN Plus. What are you most looking forward to?
Yeah, you set it up perfectly there. Just the all four teams who won the opening week. How do they respond to success coming into the second week, and then the wait for the second win in terms of this Chaos Cannons game is going to be interesting to follow, because I'm not sure if the Cannons can't beat a Chaos squad hungover from Bandit Land, and they're going to have a tough season ahead. Now, they're a resilient group. We gave them that, but the other matchups I'm really looking forward to. They're all very complete teams. When you look at the matchups head to head with the Whips, Atlas, and then the two Friday night games are going to be pretty epic. I think I'm most looking forward to Water Dogs Redwoods for the Friday night nightcapper. Just in terms of the champs versus the highlight reel, Garnsey, and everything that comes with the Redwoods. So it's going to be another fun week.
Well, Kevin, as always, we appreciate your time on the PL Happy Hour podcast. We'll be back next week. I am going to be rejoined by my tailgate co-host, Nick Acello, as we talk about week two action. And then before you know it, it'll be time to talk about week three. So if you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. We'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.